Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 45 of Prog Notes. My name is Destin.
And I'm Drew.
And today we are listening to Power Windows by Rush. If this is your first time listening to our show, or maybe you're a longtime listener, or maybe you're from the projects of Manhattan, welcome. We like to talk about different territories of progressive rock music, a fun, exciting subgenre of rock music. This is our 45th episode. So this has been one marathon of a podcast, but we're honored that you're with us. We would love to connect with you and connect you to all the other people who really love these mystic rhythms. So follow us on all the grand designs of the internet. That is Instagram, Facebook, the Discord chat community. The link of that is in the episode's description. And we always want to say thank you to all of our patrons who give us the big money to help the show continue to be a reality. You can become a patron by visiting our website or check the link in the description. That will help our small Middletown dreams for this show become a reality. That was pretty good. What do you think? That's pretty good, right?
I don't know about
good. I thought it was pretty good.
That's a very subjective term. But I put effort into it.
I did.
A for effort.
I did. It took me like 3 minutes. It was actually not really that difficult
C
to do.
C for effort.
Yeah, C for effort.
It's passable.
But lastly, before we jump into the episode, we have some great news regarding our offshoot podcast, Spotlight. Hopefully you all have been enjoying some great interviews and discovering some new prog material from Rogan, who is running Spotlight. Of course, we have been hosting those episodes on this feed, but because of the sheer volume of bands who want to be on the show, as well as the listeners who've been joining Spotlight, we are now moving Spotlight to its own podcast feed. Yes, so if you don't want to miss any episodes of Spotlight, here's what you need to do. You need to find the description. In the description, right now, there's a link that you need to tap on that, and it will help follow Spotlight. So go to the description of the episode and tap on that link and then hit follow Spotlight, and that will take you to their new feed. So we're very excited for him to start posting new material and having more guests on the show. But I'm giving you guys a warning now. All of the Spotlight episodes that are coming on our feed are now going to go to its own feed very soon. And he'll have more interviews and guests on their show. And speaking of guests, I'm detecting some very positive emotions and vibes in here. That's really bad. And that's because our great friend Rachel Brown is joining us today. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, thank you. Great to be back.
We were just talking earlier before the show started of how long it's been since you've joined us on an episode. And the answer was it's been way too long. But Rachel has been on several episodes within the life of this podcast, including our fifth most listened to episode ever as of right now, which is episode 27, Animals by Pink Floyd. She also joined us on episode 23, with Hand Cannot Erase by Stephen Wilson. She also joined us with episode 10 of Tales of Mystery and Imagination by Alan Parsons Project. And of course, episode 4, way back in the day, when we did Sgt. Pepper's by the Beatles. It's been too long, so we're very glad to have you back and make the drive out here to make this happen.
It has been too long. I'm just waiting to... Every time the phone rings, I just hope it's Destin and Drew. You know,
right.
When are you going to be back?
It's a pretty
every time, and
life.
I'm always disappointed, like except the other day.
For the one time they called me.
Oh my gosh, I have a reason to live.
Oh my Lord. Now, we've done several Rush records, and I'm excited that you're joining us on a Rush record. Because
I am,
you know,
too.
That's
you guys love Rush, and you know, it was one of the first kind of introductions into prog for me as well. Or like really, really prog versus, you know, we've talked about like psychedelic kind of prog as well, but kind of crosses into rock, like with Pink Floyd and stuff. So
yeah,
I was very honored to get to weigh in on a Rush record.
Well, I credit you for getting me kind of hooked on Rush, because it was in your car that we listened to on Shuffle. The Spirit of Radio randomly came on. I said, what is this?
Yeah.
And you're like, and at that time, Dad gave me some Rush or something.
Yeah, at that time I was really loving Permanent Wave. Yeah, that was the one that Dad gave me. He was like, here, just check this one out. So,
fantastic record.
We've done several Rush records on the podcast, but specifically why we wanted to do another one for episode 45. Drew, why don't you tell us the story of why we're doing another Rush record for episode 45?
Someone on our Discord had pointed out, all right, so which Rush record is going to be episode 45? And you and I were both like, what are you talking? Why would you assume that it's going to be that one? And they said, well, you've done one every 15 episodes. And we didn't even, that was completely by accident. It was our first episode was 2112. Our 15th episode was Moving Pictures with Bez. And then our 30th episode was Caress of Steel. Totally by accident. It was not planned at all. And then someone on the Discord was like, all right. Which one's it going
to
be?
Which one's it going to be? So now we feel like we have to do it. So I feel like it's going to be a thing.
Yeah, so every 15 episodes, we've got to do it. And once we run out, I guess, well, we'll go from there.
Yeah, that's a lot of episodes, though.
But, anyways. And I think that this will be a fun one to do because we haven't done one that is really into their 80s sound or anything past their 80s sound.
It's true.
I mean, technically...
81
is Moving Pictures, but I don't consider that part of their quote unquote 80s sound where they heavily lean into the synthesized sounds. And we'll get into that a little bit more later. But this will be a fun one to do because I think it's markedly different from any of the other Rush records we've covered in the past.
Most definitely. I'm excited. So Power Windows is the 11th Rush album released on October 14th, 1985 by Anthem Records. The lineup is, of course, Neil Peart on drums, who also serves as the lyricist, Alex Lifeson on guitars, and Geddy Lee on bass, synths, and vocals. This album was recorded in 5 different studios and was the first album that Peter Collins produced for the band. He would go on to produce the next 4 and was also the first Rush album to ever be released directly to CD. But that didn't interrupt sales, however, because the record went platinum within 4 months of its release. So fans seemed to enjoy it. Obviously, with a platinum record within 4 months. But what did the critics think about this, Drew? Do you have any reviews of maybe some reviews at the time of what people were thinking about what they thought of Rush going 80s?
I know we had a lot of have a lot to cover, so I won't clog this too much with reviews. Prague Archives, which I frequently go to, gave it a 3.55 stars out of 5 from over 1,000 users. 22% gave it a perfect score. You're probably going to get some diehard Rush fans who just love Rush
like
love their 80s sound. 38% gave it a 4 out of 5. So 60% think it's pretty great. But honestly, that's not as high compared to a lot of the other popular prog albums we've covered on the show. So
yeah,
that means 40% don't really think it's that great. I mean, you know, a 3 out of 5 is not that great. It's kind of like, I listened to it. Okay. Yeah, it was solid. But I probably won't go back to it actively seeking this record again. So I know a lot of the stuff that we've covered on here from a variety of different bands is like, you know, over 80% give it either a 4 or 5. Right. So I actually, usually I give like a really positive review and a really fairly negative review. I'm going to give 2 middle of the road reviews. I'm going to give two that are just kind of, this was a 3 out of 5, and they explain why. Someone give it a 3 out of 5. And they had some really good points to make. They said, from a progressive viewpoint, this album is nothing special. It doesn't have any 20-minute long epics like previous albums from the band. It's not very exploratory. The lyrics aren't very complex. The themes are fairly simple. If I look at this album in terms of what it did for prog and how it deepened the genre, I'd have to say it's probably a 2 out of 5. But this album for me really is a 5 out of 5, personally. This album's great because it was a definitive, sorry, not because it was a definitive prog album. It's great because every song on it is solid. The best part about this album is its lyrical simplicity. It doesn't take you on a complex adventure. Rather, it gives you a short and simple idea. However, these simple ideas are powerful. Neil Peart's goal was to give the listener a general idea of his opinion and then allow listeners to make their own opinions about the topic. Musically, the album is fantastic, and how could it not be? It's Rush. Unless you absolutely hate synth, which if you do, I'm not sure you like prog anyways, you can respect this album. So I thought that was an interesting excerpt. And I'll give another review here from Dave Kahn. The first one was from Megan, and I didn't... Sorry, I think of Megan, and I think of Key and Peele, that sketch.
Megan, come back to the bar!
No!
Sorry. All right. This person also gave it a 3 out of 5. Sorry. Every now and then I read these very like writer's descriptions. You know what I'm talking about? A lean winter wolf of an album, sinuous and cunning. Power Windows recaptures much of Signal's energy, best exemplified on the Big Money. Sorry, it's a good review. It's just some of these phrases. It's not a complete return to form, but it is a better balance between old and new. The rhythm section of Geddy Lee and Neil Peart is superlative in every sense of the word, while the subject matter is classic Rush, preserving the personal and an impersonal system bent on domination and destruction. However, it's clear to say that the synthesizers and Alex Lifeson's shimmering guitar style are here to stay. I miss the saturated sound of vintage Rush, the unbridled enthusiasm of their arrangements, the idealism of their vision. But those days passed with the 70s. The new Rush, clinical, cynical, and mechanical, is the byproduct of musical evolution. In appearance, we shouldn't equate familiar with attractive, especially when the change in appearance enabled the band to remain vital without sacrificing integrity. And this following statement is pretty important, I think. I can't think of any prog band that's aged as well as Rush over the years.
Ooh.
Power Windows' failure is a weary familiarity from song to song, a brittle inflexibility that ironically costs the music its own individuality. The Big Money is handily the album's money shot. The fact that the thoughtful Mystic Rhythms was tested as the second single testifies to a lack of viable alternatives. So that was the end of the review. I think that that's, you know, you've got your good and your bad.
Middle
right?
of the road. It's the yeah. middle of the road.
Middle
review.
Of the road.
I think one thing that we could all see, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I can't think of many other bands that kept the same lineup starting from the 70s going into the 80s. You know, Yes changed lineups. Genesis changed lineups going into the 80s. I mean, if you're thinking of King Crimson, I think King Crimson also changed lineups going into
definitely.
The 80s. So, like, they were... when you bring in different people, obviously you changed regardless, but to have the same three people produce different music during during a different time period as well also says something to their credit, I think.
Yeah, definitely. I wanted to know from Rachel just overall opinions of this record, just in general.
From me. Okay.
I
love Power Windows. It is one of my favorite Rush records. I do appreciate and enjoy your more proggy early Rush, but I like 80s Rush. I like 80s music when, you know, stepping away from the progressive realm for a moment. I do appreciate 80s pop. I really enjoy it. And some of the other rock from the 80s because I do enjoy synth. Now, again, sometimes it is a bit overused,
yeah,
say the least. And I wasn't necessarily talking about Power Windows, but I will say I kind of listened to this album for this whole week, a week straight, and it was a bit like, okay, I'm ready to move on to something else now, you know, or I want something that feels a little more raw. It does have a very more produced feel to it to me than some of their other earlier work, but I really do love Power Windows. It's got some of my favorite Rush songs on it, actually. So
nice. This for me was not one I liked starting out. It took me a while to get used to. I was very much in the camp of a lot of Rush fans still today. A lot of Rush fans, even diehard ones, are like, love their 70s stuff, really stay away from and avoid their super 80s synthesized sound.
Which is really like that. It's like that 82 to 87. It's like signals through Hold Your Fire.
Yeah, it signals through Hold Your Fire, I think. Is where it's really, really synth. And I would say, I think most people would agree that Power Windows is probably their most synth-heavy record. I was listening because I thought maybe Grace Under Pressure would be a little bit more. And I listened to Grace Under Pressure, which is directly before this. I notice, this is kind of weird to say, I when just casual listen through, I notice guitars more on Grace Under Pressure than I do on Power Windows. However, we're going to go into the guitars later in some sections on this episode about Power Windows and the brilliance of those guitars. But I will say, I notice them more even on Grace Under Pressure than on Power Windows. But anyways, I don't immediately fall in love with every single Rush record the first time I hear it. Believe it or not.
No, yeah.
In fact, there are still some that I don't like. And that's hard for me to say as a diehard Rush fan. But I'm sorry, Test for Echo is not your shining hour.
Not their best
hour. It was not. Rush, I love you. But anyways, starting with Signals, when I was really starting to explore Rush, I started with their 70s stuff, their raw stuff, and then I kind of dipped into the 80s stuff. And I'll be honest, I did a cannonball into the early stuff. Loved it. And it was submerged immediately, and I loved almost everything I heard. I definitely waded into the pool that was the 80s sound. And eventually, yeah. I liked it and became to swim around it, and I loved it. But I think I credit a lot of that to Caleb, our friend.
We
had a musician friend starting out when we were in high school with our bands, and he's a drummer. And he loved a lot of their 80s stuff, and he was a diehard Rush fan as well. And I remember turning on the vinyl of Power Windows, and I remember not really caring for it, besides The Big Money. I heard The Big Money, and I was like, that's an amazing track, right? That's got great energy, really great riffs. It's just a fun song. That's great. And I remember listening to the rest of it, and I was like, this is a chore to get through. This is a chore to get through. And then I listened to it more and more, and I was like, oh my gosh, there's actually some really brilliant stuff on here. There's some really great stuff on here. But anyways, that's my first experience with Power Windows and their departure into a much more heavily synthesized sound. Again, they had done that with records before this, but...
Well, and I will say that I like Power Windows better than some of their other 80s stuff as well.
Almost definitely.
Yeah. I'm not a big fan of Grace Under Pressure. There's some, you know, again, there's no Rush album where I can be like, the whole thing's garbage, you know, even just from like an enjoyment standpoint, not talking about even just musically, obviously none of it's garbage on, you know, from music, but like for my own palate and what I enjoy listening to, which is very broad, there's still, you know, there's always at least, you know, several moments that I'm like, oh, this is amazing, I love this, you know, no matter what, you know, the Rush album, even on a couple of things on Test for Echo that I do like. But this one to me, I have this one on vinyl. Like, I absolutely love Power Windows. But again, like I was, you know, saying before, and to your credit, Drew, like, I can't, you know, I've listened to it for a week straight, probably won't be picking it up for a while again. You know, it is very synthy, and even me becomes, okay, there's a point where I don't want to listen to that anymore.
Yeah. You kind of wear it out at least a little bit.
Yeah.
Over time listening to it. Yeah. I do think that it's, thank God Rush was around in the 70s and beyond the 80s, because if we just had their 80s catalog, I mean, they wouldn't be who they are today.
It would be a little bit more limited. Yeah. You know, it's just like, this is all they do. But I think for me, especially since lyrics, and we've talked about this in multiple podcasts before, the lyrics are really important to me in music. And I really love the lyrics on Power Windows. I love the message of the album. So that's probably another reason why I really enjoy this record.
Well, speaking of the lyrics, I have to say, when I think this is some of Peart's best work. When I think of Peart's great lyrics, I'm not kidding. The image that comes into head is this album cover.
Yeah.
And I think part of that is definitely Mystic Rhythms, but there's a lot of really great tracks on here. And lyrically, fun fact, it's a lyric from this record that is my high school senior year quote.
There you go.
Yes.
There you go.
It's Grand Designs. We break the surface tension with our wild kinetic dreams.
I think every time I hear that. Yes.
It's a fantastic phrase. I agree with you, Rachel. I think this is some of his best work lyrically. Yeah. And that's saying something, because lyrics are something that Peart does very well.
Yeah, there's so many other, you know, songs that I could pick out from other albums that are also just as amazing. But this is every song all the way through. I just love. And again, I like I said, the culmination of what the message of the album is. Mm-hmm. You know, there's obviously a little darkness to it, but there's also light in it, which is beautiful, and I like that.
Yeah most definitely. I mean, speaking of the lyrics, could you enlighten us a little bit on sort of some of the themes that run throughout Power Windows, and just what you attach to the most in the lyrics?
I mean, obviously, you know, Power Windows is addressing the different avenues of power and the, you know, the, you've got lots of themes of greed, you know, obviously big money.
I mean, big money. Yeah.
In some ways, it's not very hard to interpret. It's not shadowed at all. It's very, the lyric is what it says, you know, but I really like that because you also have little bits of hope throughout the, you know, like the people, the concept of just grasping for power, grasping for money, grasping for the next big thing.
Mm-hmm.
You have also the message of hope in Grand Designs and in Emotion Detector. There's a lot of humanity as well that's addressed in the album too, that I really love, because the emphasis is placed on this is what matters more than the power, the greed. And of course, that's all there. And I like the way that it's addressed in a very, in some ways, snarky. That's not necessarily the word I'm looking for, but I guess it does fit as well, like in territories.
Mm-hmm.
And the tragedy, of course, of grasping for power, you know, Manhattan Project. But again, there is light within the album too. And I appreciate that.
Yeah. I think that's one of the things that drew, you've mentioned in the past, being that one of the great things, or the golden era of Neil's lyrics is being quoted the 80s. Because in the 70s, everything was very mystical. A lot of different, there's just sci-fi, all kinds of different stuff. It was very kind of fiction based. And now he's sort of like moving into more of a, writing more, a little bit about humanity.
More directly.
More directly.
He's addressing these issues with a more direct approach.
Yeah. And even, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you said, or maybe I believe it, but I think it was some, I mean, obviously when we did the Tribute to Neil Peart episode, I think your number one favorite lyrics was Bravado, which was from 91, from Roll the Bones, right? But then I believe
that album.
Like the rest of them, right, were, I think, like your top five were in that 80s realm, I think. Is that right?
Yeah, that would make sense. I honestly need to go back and look at my list. I think the majority of them were probably from the 80s.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is the golden era of Neil's lyrics, that's for sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Even going, would you even agree going into Counterparts? Like, would Counterparts still be in there? Is that still, for both of you guys, like, is that still a record that is... Or is that when things started getting a little hairy?
I don't think any musician's flawless in almost anything that they do. Sure. And I think that... the 90s stuff for me, for Neil, Counterparts and Test for Echo are not his best. Like there are moments here and there, like Rachel said, like I agree with her. There's not a Rush record where there's not one track. I was dogging on Test for Echo. I still like Resist. I still like Driven. I still think the title track Test for Echo
is good. I enjoy Totem. That one's.
But by and large, that includes a degradation in lyrical quality as well. I mean, music reflects the lyrics in a way. They go hand in hand, and I've mentioned that before on the podcast. Yep. I think that a lyric can be vastly more impactful if it's delivered with music that is so
absolutely
emotionally penetrating. I guess as well.
Yeah.
Something that really just kind of hits home for you, that just breaks through all the surface. Anyways.
I mean, your favorite, you know, lyric that you used as your high school quote, you know, I mean, we break the surface tension with our wild kinetic dreams. I mean, the way that is sung and especially when it's repeated the second time, I mean, it gets me every time.
Yeah, man.
Every time.
So good.
Yeah.
Speaking of Getty, there's this, I have a quote here that he kind of talks about Getty in the 80s. And so it's a little bit, there's some other things that he says in here, but this is the quote. He says, "What makes Power Windows somewhat of an anomaly in the Rush back catalog up to that point is that it marks the first time the band brought an outside help to help enhance its music, which until then was made to be replicated live by the trio. But by 1985, sequencers and samplers were changing the landscape of what rock music could do, and the keyboard programming of Andy Richards would be triggered in concert via pedals. Also notable about the album is that it contains, this is the quote, Lee's strongest singing to date, as he was becoming much more confident as a lead singer rather than a shrieker. He starts to show some serious range and emotional depth on this album, especially on tracks like Grand Designs, and Middletown Dreams, to your point that you just mentioned with Grand Design. So my question would be, do you guys agree with this?
I think I yeah. I mean, you notice in the 80s he gets better and better as a singer. Now, I love the the early stuff, but it's unrefined, and I don't think that he had very much training, and he was still early in his career.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, I will admit, like, what can I sing along to? It's going to be the stuff from the 80s. It's hard for me to sing along to 2112, right?
You know,
the Temples of Syrinx is really difficult to kind of sing along.
You sure you don't like singing along to Finding My Way?
That I mean, but, and maybe subconsciously, because I've never thought about it. I have never actually thought about, oh, Getty's voice just sounds better on this too, because I'm just like, I just like the, you know, I love the music and I love, again, the way it's delivered and sung. But I never thought that maybe the quality itself of the range, that as it improved, that may be another reason subconsciously why I gravitate to this album. I would absolutely agree.
Yeah. I mean, he definitely, obviously he's aged a little bit. So with age, voice changes a little bit. But I do think though that becoming, just, he said in the quote here, said becoming much more confident as a lead singer rather than a shrieker. And just thinking about that, I was like, oh my gosh, yeah, you know what? Like, we were talking about that on our very first episode. We were talking about on 2112 how, hey, if 2112 isn't your cup of tea, don't give up on them. Because
don't give up
mainly
on Rush. That's right.
The only thing that people were telling me that the reason why they don't like 2112 is because of the vocals. You know, there's several different phases of Rush that, especially when they get into it. Now, me personally, I think he said Lee's strongest singing to date, and which was up to this point, right? But I'd have to say that, I don't know, I really love the vocals on Roll the Bones.
Oh, me too.
Up to that. The vocals on Roll the Bones is so good.
Yeah.
But all of the 80s stuff to start with is really
great. Well, I think it's noticeably more, it blends better with the with a melody, with something you can sing along
to
something that you can kind of latch on to, and that's this record. Noticeably, the vocal melodies throughout each song, you can kind of latch on to them a bit easier than you could with, I would say, any I would agree with that quote to that point anything preceding this.
Yep.
You can sing along with this better than you can with anything. Oh, maybe not anything, but overall, more than you can with even Moving Pictures. Or, you know, there's some other really popular stuff. Moving Pictures or Signals or Grace Under Pressure, as his voice is developing. This to me, is really, really noticeable in that respect, in his voice.
I think the very first song that was starting to gravitate, but I think one of the very first songs that I fell in love with from the vocal melody perspective was actually New World Man from Signals.
Mm. Yeah.
Very catchy song, pretty fun song to sing, and fun song to play, coming from a drummer's perspective. But it kind of just got better and better from there, just onward from Signals into the 80s. And so, yeah, I thought that was an interesting quote that I never really thought about. I was like, oh, wait, yeah, Getty's voice is totally changing, and it actually sounds really great from a singing perspective. Drew, you got a book right there? You're about to read something, or
me?
Yeah,
I have it. When we were gonna talk more about the lyrics, but I didn't know if Rachel had something more to say about.
Oh no, I'm like, you want to dig into lyrics? I love digging into lyrics.
Some of the lyrical content.
Digging into the lyrical content.
I had a quote from Peart about this, and I thought it was interesting. He also kind of combines this record with Hold Your Fire. So what does he say? He says, in much the same manner that he visualizes A Farewell to Kings and Hemispheres as a duo, Peart looks at Power Windows and Hold Your Fire. Whoo, guys, I'm in rare form today. I'm on fire. Peart looks at Power Windows and Hold Your Fire as forming a synergistic pairing.
I can see it.
And then he tries to kind of, prompted to see, well, what are some of the differences between the two, if you think those are kind of similar. He says, Hold Your Fire is somehow a little more introvert in mood, musically and lyrically, as much as they tend to feed on each other. That definitely strikes me now, just thinking about it. Power Windows is more dynamic and more extrovert, while Hold Your Fire is more textural and introvert, both lyrically and musically. And then he likes them both. But I agree with that. I think there are more I statements and using the first person perspective in Hold Your Fire than there is on
Agreed
Right, than there is on Power Windows. Power Windows is very much like, this is territories. This is what the big money is. These are abstract concepts, very loose concepts that everyone understands, and I'm just going to talk about them.
Right. And then we're going to tie it to humanity at large. Right.
Absolutely. Huh. Rather than saying, hey, this is how I feel, and can you relate to that as well with something in Hold Your Fire, right?
So, wow. Never thought about that. That's a good way of looking at it.
But at the same time, the minute you say that, again, things that I had not before thought of, tying the two albums together, but there are very similar messages. You know, sometimes it's like, you know, I mean, you have Mission, and you have other positive, hopeful songs that are on Hold Your Fire that I do kind of connect with a lot of similar themes from Power Windows in a different way.
Hmm. I never thought about that. Never thought about the introvert extrovert thing. Is still I'm like still thinking about that. Going back through like all of the both of the albums now. I'm like thinking through Hold Your Fire. I'm going like all the songs. Wow. Yeah, that makes sense. It's a good quote, Drew. Thanks for that.
You're welcome.
Yeah, no problem.
No problem to your welcome.
No
Thanks.
Problem
you're
to welcome. Your welcome.
No problem.
Yeah, no problem.
People do that, though.
I know.
That's a thing.
I know, man.
That's a thing. People will be like, you're welcome. Deal. Yeah, no problem.
No problem.
No, you're the one who thanked me initially.
Uh-huh.
Why are you... What?
Or my favorite is the, hey, have a good day. Good. Mm-hmm. Like, they, instead of like, you know, I think you're saying, yeah. they just programmed themselves to already just say good, you know, because they'll think like, how's your day? Or, you know.
Yeah, no, I've done it. But you know, also from the perspective of someone who worked customer service for so long, you just get so used to the lingo, and it's just I know that I've like been, how are you doing today?
So
blah blah blah. We continue for a second. Oh, so how are you doing? I'm like, I just asked this person that. Why am I asking them again?
That's great. Maybe it's changed since you've been talking to them. So hopefully it's been better.
Maybe they're having a better day.
Wouldn't that be great if somebody said good, and then 5 minutes later you're talking to them, and then you ask the same question, and they say excellent.
Because I found the thing that I was looking for.
Yes, you have helped me today. Okay.
You have helped me today.
Anyway.
Today went from good to great.
Yeah. Then I little Disney magic for you.
Little
it better
Disney.
Have, or I failed.
That's right.
Oh, okay.
This is the first record with their producer, Peter Collins. I think it's important to kind of talk about his contribution to this group. And I know that in their previous records, early starting out, they worked with producer Terry Brown for a fair chunk of their early catalog, if not all of it. And then I think Grace Under Pressure was Peter Henderson, if I'm not mistaken. And then, you know, right after that comes Power Windows. And this is where they introduce Peter Collins, who worked on this and Hold Your Fire. He actually worked on a lot of other really popular acts at the time. One of the most notable was Queensreek. He was on their 1988 record, Operation Mindcrime, which I think is a pretty important record for that band. I am not intimately familiar with their catalog, to be honest. But Queensreak was a pretty big rock group back in the 80s and everything. I thought that it would be interesting to get his perspective when he was working with Rush. And he had said, it was just a question of coming in fresh and getting them to change some things they'd always done. If there's somebody to say to them, guys, I think that section could be better, it could be more exciting, or it could be more laid back, whatever, they like that. They like to be challenged. In the case of Rush, they strive to be better with every record. They strive to progress with every record. AC/DC strive to sound exactly as they did on their first record, on their 14th record. Mm. It's the same thing. And that's their strength. But Rush want to be different on every record and to progress. As human beings, that's the way they are. They're very interesting people, and they need continual intellectual and musical stimulation. I think that really was what they were going for. This wasn't like, hey, we're getting like lazy, or we're trying to conform to the synthesized sound that is so popular now. But it's like, no, this is like part of the world now. This is a musical innovation. And yes, a lot of pop culture groups are using it as well, but also progressive rock in general had already, like from the get-go, wanted to implement newer technologies and newer sounds and implement an interesting contrast to what had been, right? And that's kind of part of the progressive rock. Sorry, Rachel, you look like you want to say something.
Well, yeah, it's I very much tie this to and tie Rush to the Beatles, because the Beatles were a lot of people wondered when their sound started to change from that very poppy "I Want to Hold Your Hand" phase into Rubber Soul, which was a huge, you know, turning point for them. So you had Hard Day's Night, and then you've got Help and Rubber Soul, and you can see the gradual shift. And some people were wondering, are they being influenced instead of being the influencers? But it is a combination. The Beatles wanted they were a reflection of the era and the changes that were occurring in the mid and late 60s, away from that late 1950s cookie cutter Americana, you know, popular bubblegum pop thing. They were transforming, you know, but also creating their own. And they were wanting to experiment with new technologies. And I think about Rush the same way. It's like they want to sound different. The Beatles wanted to sound different. And they were continuing to, but they're going to use new things that are starting to evolve. And they're going to be, you know, influenced by the avant-garde and, you know, some of the other hippie culture that was starting to pervade.
Yeah.
Western culture at the time. So I've read many things where it was just this kind of simultaneous, the Beatles were affected by while they also affected the culture.
Yeah.
And I think that Rush is the same.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that to the point that I had, well, that the reviewer had made earlier about saying that Rush, like, I can't think of any prog band that's aged as well as them over the years. Mm-hmm. I think they also just maintain that integrity in a sense that, yes, it's a very different sound than what you're used to, but it's still progressing. And that's still, you know, trying to combine that with what Peter Collins has said, they like to be challenged and they like to progress in a different way. And I think that it's very different sound, but it is still very much Rush. And I think most any Rush fan would agree. It's like, yeah, I can still hear that amazing, insane bass riff. And oh, those drum parts are still amazing. And yes, the lyrical content is kind of different in its form, but its substance is still there. It's still something that makes you
think, if you will. Like what you were saying, Destin, the versus the complete transformation of bands like Yes, where, you know,
right, totally.
I think we've talked about this before, where, you know, that people even started to refer to Yes as Yes West, because they moved to like California. They had a totally different sound, and it didn't have any of the same strands, you know, that they were still holding on to be like, no, but this is still the core of what we do. It was just, no, now this is what's popular. And maybe at first it did kind of start out as an experiment, but it was also like a, hey, we want to remain relevant. And to do that, we're going to conform without even keeping our old flavor.
And some of that also has to do with what Destin was talking about earlier with the lineup.
The lineup
it's
is
a very
big
different
deal.
Lineup in the 80s for Yes. And at Rush, these were the same three guys that have been working together for the last 10 years, right?
Yep. So absolutely. And linking it back to the Beatles again, it was the same four guys doing this. So it was like, we're on this journey together, and we have a history that is not just being wiped out by somebody else coming in.
Yep.
Right.
And not necessarily taking over, but still having their totally different influence.
So then why do people not like it? Like, what's...
Why don't they like the power window, the
like,
Rush?
Why is this not a, why is this not a 4.5? Why is this not a 4.5 out of 5? Why is this like a 3.5? Why is this a 3 out of 5?
Why are we so different in our opinion?
It very much depends on who you ask, right?
Right.
Because I know I've heard people say, but mainly strangers, to be honest, you know, people online that I've seen or people in documentaries talking about, oh, I just really like the raucous part and it doesn't seem as raw. And that's a term Rachel used earlier. It doesn't seem as raw. It seems more produced or whatever. However, the people I do know personally who also enjoy Rush, almost all of them love this record, if not say it's their favorite. I'm not even kidding, right? I think
it's one of mine.
Marcus says it's like right up there neck and neck with Presto for him. Mm-hmm. Like those are his two favorite Rush
records.
Presto. And Rogan of Spotlight, I think he says
he loves Power Windows too. Yeah.
He loves, I don't know if he says it's his favorite, but like he raves about it, right? So the people I know personally absolutely adore this album.
Now, do they also speak that way though of their 70s stuff? Like, would you have somebody telling you that they love Power Windows? Maybe not as much as, like, I mean, if it's their favorite album, but also raving about moving pictures, permanent waves. You know, what...
Yeah.
Do they speak the same of 70s Rush versus 80s? Or is it like, no, I mark it, not just dislike, but I markedly love 80s Rush.
Yeah, I think the... at least the perspective I would think is that from just people don't like change. And I think from somebody who just enjoyed the 70s stuff and getting into them, 9 times out of 10, you're probably getting into Rush from their 70s stuff. Maybe. I would, in my experience of talking to some young guys, teenagers that are in our Discord channel, you know, they're big fan of the 70s, not really gotten into the whole 80s thing. And from that point, I think it was just they don't like change. Not wanting to hear that sound differently, or hearing that 80s sound, I suppose. But what were you going to say, Drew?
Well, I was just going to say, if you're going to get into Rush, you probably get into that if you're coming from the perspective of progressive rock.
Yes.
Their early stuff is much more quote unquote classic progressive rock.
Yes, most definitely.
With the length of the songs, with the early synthesizer sounds rather than
the
80s,
concepts.
Right?
With the concepts. Yeah.
With the conceptual themes and you know, these weird esoteric arcane lyrics and all this kind of stuff, right? I mean, that was very headspacey stuff. It was very heady stuff, which is
there's kind of a checklist of things that were in the early 70s, and for the people who were really prog people, like the people who really loved progressive rock music.
Is Power Windows still progressive rock? Undoubtedly, in my mind, undoubtedly. But a lot of the key early elements of early prog are missing or maybe subdued.
So in that way, do you think that if you had someone that was not as big of a fan of progressive, the raw, classic progressive rock,
right,
it would be easier to ease them into Rush by giving them an 80s record?
100%.
Yeah. Oh, that's my wife. Yes. That's my wife, 100%. Yeah, because it's like it's well, more accessible
and,
from that way.
What do
vocals,
one people...
Yeah.
I was about to say vocals. What do one thing that people really latch onto when they first hear a song? It's the rhythm and it is the vocals.
Absolutely.
Right? And as we mentioned earlier, Getty's voice matured significantly. And again, on this record, it's noticeably more pleasing than it is their earlier stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So it makes sense that, you know, if you want people to kind of wade into the water of progressive rock, then maybe show them this, and maybe they can be like, oh, it is kind of cool that that bass is really complicated, and then start to show them and inundate them with some of the earlier stuff. So,
but even in the earlier stuff, you did have, again, like, you know, you had radio hits, you had Tom Sawyer, you had, and even somewhat simpler songs, thinking of Cinderella Man and Closer to the Heart, you know, not like, you know, just there were still accessible quote-unquote, songs from their early stuff that you could probably pick out as well and be like, here's this whole album. If you liked that song, okay, now try the whole thing on for size, you know?
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's good. I have another quote here from... It was a quote from the time, from like the 1980s era, from Getty, actually talking about... the question that was asked to him was, so why did you go 80s? Quote unquote. Right. And I was like, this is going to be great. This is what he says. This is coming from Getty Lee himself. He says, any style done really well, I really like. Whether it be a big, dense wall of sound or whether it be a minimalist school, it just depends on what the execution is like and if it works. Around Grace Under Pressure time, we were really obsessed with that way. And if we should be that way too, we should be minimalistic and try to learn that way of thinking, that way of looking at your songwriting. I think it's very important for a musician to understand what the language of today's musician is. I think it's a bad thing to insist your way of doing things is the only way. Again, people don't like change, right? If you want to learn and if you want to communicate with people today, you have to use the tools of today. And I think that was the desire, to stay contemporary and to stay in part of the mainstream of things, the way that things are going. That's how you become a dinosaur, by refusing to accept that things are changing and refusing to accept that you can learn from this scene. I think it's very important for us to stay in touch and to learn. We don't sit there and go, "Erg, this new music is garbage. There's nothing to be learned here." We say, "Wow, this is great. This is something different. I've never thought of that. Maybe I can apply those techniques or these attitudes to my music and make my music better." So that's it. That's the desire. That's the goal. Getty Lee embraces the change of what is, you know, the influencing, right? Taking what's being thrown at him and saying, this is what we can do to throw it out to influence others. It's kind of like going back to what Waitrose was saying earlier.
Well, and Drew and I have had conversations about this multiple times, talking about, you know, you've brought up a couple of times Roll the Bones. That's also another one of my favorite Rush albums, and they throw rap in there.
Yeah.
You know, because that was emerging, you know, and I'm sure there are lots of people who dislike that.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Myself included, as far as I am not a rap fan. But again, Rush was, you know what, we're going to try on something new.
Yeah,
you know,
it's not like they had Kendrick Lamar walk on stage, like
right. This wasn't the Super Bowl, but like it they utilized it in a different way, and I actually really enjoy Roll the Bones.
Yeah,
really enjoy it.
It's great. So we've talked about Getty a little bit. We've talked about Neil's lyrics. You want to talk about Lifeson? I'm going to talk about Alex's guitar parts throughout the 80s.
I want to stay on Getty for just
a— Oh, you want to stay on Getty? All right.
Just real quick, with bass particularly, in general, because I thought this was an interesting quote that I had found from Peter Collins. We were just talking about him and his influence on them.
Yeah.
And everything like that, that he worked with. He was kind of known as like a pop producer at the
time. Right,
right. Working with this prog rock band. But Peter Collins is from England, right? He came over to America, and I think he's been here ever since he moved. I forget exactly when he did, but he started out in England. And on the topic of prog rock, he had an interesting perspective. Keep in mind, prog rock started in England. Absolutely, it was a genre that was an English thing for, you know, when it started out. I found when I came to America that the American sense of bottom end is very different to the English perception of bottom end. The English perception is much tighter, doesn't go as low. It's not as warm or as fat. It's crunchier. It approaches the mid-range. I think that's pretty much always been the case in British pop and rock music, a different sensibility to bottom end. I've noticed time and time again that British records seem very light to me at the bottom. It's a sweeping generalization, but Americans notice it as well. And that's why they have so much British stuff remastered in America. As to why, this was interesting. One reason for the British perception of bottom end may have been Radio 1, which is a radio station out there.
Okay.
Because they have so much compression on Radio 1, if you've got too much bottom end, that compression would make your record sound quieter over the radio when the record hits the compressors. I'm going back now because I think Radio 1 is much more hi-fi than it used to be. In my day, in the early 80s, Radio 1 was everything. And if you weren't on Radio 1, you could forget it. British stuff traditionally has always been very heavily compressed. Americans, until recently, have been a bit more judicious with the compression. Anyways, thought that was interesting. Because I had noticed, I was like, one thing I love about prog rock is that the bass isn't too, like, I like that mid-rangey feel. I like that kind of crunchy feel. I love the Chris Squire type of Rickenbacker bass sound to it and everything.
Almost like that 1K frequency nasally kind of thing.
I love that kind of stuff. Yeah. And with Getty, it's absolutely there too. It's so prominent. Like, you can't listen to a Rush record and not notice the bass. And it's not just because of like the composition itself, which in and of itself you can't really ignore, but it's also the actual tone of it.
Yep.
And throughout all the Rush records. And it's funny because they're Canadian, they're not English, but still, I thought that was interesting from the perspective of a British producer. Anyways. I thought that was an interesting perspective to have. And it's also interesting, Peter Collins, that like, this is a very synthesized record. It's very produced, but he likes to take an organic approach.
Yeah.
Oh man. You started probably my favorite on the album. Oh man. This song lyrically,
it's so good.
It's my favorite. It's my favorite on the record. Every single stanza of this song lyrically is it's dynamite. It is dynamite.
It's pretty amazing.
It's funny because I think he actually prefers a much more organic approach to recording. But I think the fact that Rush really wanted to experiment with different sounds, and it was just kind of that time period, was part of it. But he said, you know, when I first worked with them, they wanted to be involved with the technological breakthroughs that were happening in England at the time, right, where he was from. So, and a lot of the new wave stuff comes from English bands as well. So
it's very common to hear this record be compared to like prog rock meeting new wave. kind of
right,
thing.
Absolutely.
Like that terminology is used all the time when describing this record and
absolutely.
Even some of the other Rush stuff in the 80s. They describe it as being new wave Rush.
Well, because the synthesizers in this are so prominent, and I think part of it is because it's not just a wall of sound synthesizer like you're hearing on stuff like Grace Under Pressure and Signals. Yes, were those heavy synthesizers used? Absolutely, but more as a backdrop. You can't ignore them, but they're not a melody. They're not really melodic. It is a big chord. It's this big... And it's used in this record as well, don't get me wrong. However, you're having these sequencers come in that are playing very fast individual notes, or Getty himself, not a sequencer, play these melodies that are, you know, short staccato little keyboard hits rather than just this big wall of sound like you're hearing on something like, I don't know, Analog Kid, or you're hearing on Distant Early Warning or something, that he's playing with his feet because it's just a big chord, right? You just click, there you go. With this, I think the keyboards themselves and playing the keyboards and or having a sequencer kind of come in and kind of play through an arpeggiator or something come through.
Yeah.
It's much more prominent in this record.
Yeah.
So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Stabs and kind of like jabs and of different synths and stuff like that popping up here and there to just add like more textural landscape to it.
Right. Yeah.
That's probably one reason this album does appeal to me more than Grace Under Pressure. Because it doesn't feel like it's just, yeah, like you said, like just a wall of synth, you know?
Just right. Rock music with a bunch of just synths just thrown on top of the record. It's just kind of like a, here we go, just going to lay a chord of this down and that'll just be our pad for this. It seems a little bit more intentional, maybe.
Just so much. Yeah. It does seem a little bit more, artful, I would say, even.
All right, sorry. You wanted to talk about Lifeson, and I do too.
Well, I feel like we've talked about Getty, or not. We've talked about Neil. Talked about Neil's lyric. We haven't even talked about Neil's drumming, but we'll have another episode for that, I guess.
Oh man, the drumming on this record is stupid
good. So good.
It is stupid good.
It's so good, and
it is absurd.
The electric stuff that he's got going on too. Like I love that he embraced
the ending of
that.
Big Money with all of those snare rolls and all the different variations of it.
Yeah.
Oh,
that stuff is great, and. Yeah, even the very beginning of Mystic Rhythms, like what just a tribal, like just an amazing intro for, you know, heck with the intro of AC/DC's Back in Black, dude. Hit me with some Mystic Rhythms. Like hit me with that beat. Hit me with that.
With Manhattan Project.
Hit me with the Manhattan
Project. Oh, gosh. Yeah. Manhattan Project is my favorite on the record. Absolutely.
So good.
I love Manhattan Project.
Man,
I love Territories as well.
Territories is pretty great.
Yeah. I love the message in Territories and Manhattan Project.
Mystic Rhythms might be my favorite, but it would be that very tightly. It'd be very tight with Marathon. Marathon is just so good to me. Like, it's got the catchiness, it's got the hooks, but it also has the awesome solo area instrumental sections and stuff like that. And I know the Mystic Rhythm has that. Mystic Rhythms, Drew, you described it as this. You just said it's just this world of wonder. It's exactly what it sounds like, which I love.
It is. You know, another rock song that has the word canopy in it? A canopy of stars? What a great phrase, man.
So good.
Nature seems to spin a supernatural way. Well, man.
It's great.
I'm just going through these lyrics. They're so good.
They're so good. But anyway, so that's Neil. We talked about Getty, the accessibility. Neil's bass. This is when he switched to the wall bass. Which was that small. It was like a small company, right? That he picked up to that. And it was the first record that he picked up that, right?
Yeah. This was the first one with the wall bass. But it's funny because you the tour that they go on, I think you see a lot of the images that you see from that are still from the Steinberger that he used on Race Under Pressure.
Okay.
But he did use the wall as well. But yeah, he used the wall from then on up until, I believe, Roll the Bones. Like somewhere around like 91 or 93.
Yeah.
He was using the wall bass pretty frequently. But you hear it on Presto, you hear it on Roll the Bones, and obviously Hold Your Fire as well. But yeah.
But right. Alex.
Alex. Okay. We're not discrediting you,
we're
Alex.
Not
we are not ignoring you.
All right.
We love you.
Okay. So let me start off with, I guess just a little quote just to kick us off into the conversation here. this comes from Lifeson. He said this, Lifeson compared the experience of recording Power Windows as much more pleasant and fun than Grace Under Pressure, which presented various problems for the band. He added that the album contained elements that Rush had not incorporated before and broke several boundaries that had existed with previous albums. Lee supported this view and said that the group decided, quote, not to hold anything back and make the album first and focus later on the music's onstage presentation, which I thought was, that's kind of interesting. A lot of people produce from the mindset of, can we replicate this live? They didn't hold anything back. They were just like, let's just go do it. We'll figure it out later. But we had
more parallels to the Beatles. Sorry.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. But we've had maybe a conversation about this in the past with Rush when it comes to the idea of when the synth started entering. I mean, Grace Under Pressure presented various problems for the band. My idea was maybe because he thought he was being replaced with these synthesizers.
I can see that. I think
possibly so.
Go ahead, Rach.
Well, I was going to say, in some of my reading on the album as well, Lifeson, you know, expressed some resistance to the emphasis on keyboards.
Yes.
During this period of their history. But he said he noted that the trend began on Signals, which pushed his guitar parts too far into the background as a result. However, he thought that Rush achieved a much greater balance with the two instruments on Power Windows.
Yes.
And he linked it to Moving Pictures, actually, meaning in the way that he thought that Moving Pictures had also successfully really done that.
Yeah. No, I would agree. I think something so special about Alex in the 80s and even just guitars in the 80s. I mean, what do you do with an album that is this synth heavy? What do you do with that? And I just love the approach that he took on this album in terms of how he wrote his guitar parts and how he changed to be able to fit into this mold of what synthesizers were doing in terms of like an engineering standpoint. In fact, we were trying to get a friend of ours to record him telling this story. But our good friend Marcus, we've mentioned him several times in the show. He was a really good friend of ours, musician friend. He produced some of our records for Arcane Atlas, for Drew and I and stuff. But at one of the Rush concerts, he ran into Peter Collins. And he had a conversation with him, very brief conversation. But he told us that he basically had one question that he could ask him in that moment. And so he asked, what amp did Alex use on Power Windows? Like, what did he do on Power Windows to get his guitars to sound that way? And what Peter Collins replied back was, he was like, I don't think I really remember, but all I do remember is that amp was extremely small. It was a very small, like, pocket little amplifier that he was playing all his guitar parts through. Of course, he was cranking it, but from an engineer's standpoint, I could totally see why that would be such a great idea, is because you're focusing on the higher registers. Bigger amplifiers can pick up obviously more of the lower registers there, but with a smaller amp, everything is a little bit more screechy and a little bit more stabby and has that kind of like harshness to it, which could poke through the warm kind of fullness of the synthesizers that are going on. Mm. And he used a lot of pinch harmonics. Once again, like super, like piercing.
Really high screech.
Yes.
You know, sounds.
In fact, and yeah. You know what? Let's go ahead and play it for him. Drew did this. Drew made this for us.
Well, you made it. I appreciate you giving me some of the credit. I identified some of the moments, and Destin compiled this little.
Yeah.
Pinch harmonic compilation. And let me preface this by saying the reason I did this was because I thought it was super noticeable. And I'm probably thinking of because of the one of the verses in Middletown Dreams, where like in between the lyrics, every two lines, he always does like a bunch of pinch harmonics.
Yes.
And I guess I just attributed that to the whole album and just kind of, whether mistakenly or not. But like,
there's a lot of them.
There are a lot of pinch harmonics.
There's
on
a
this
lot
record.
Of pinch harmonics.
And like,
on the
I
record.
Mean, that's a typical like element to incorporate in a lot of rock in general. Right. And I'm sure Alex has used it on a bunch of other Rush records. But for some reason, this record, I was like, lots of pinch harmonics. Here, man. So I went through and I clocked like a bunch of them. And Destin,
here we go.
Destin made this.
Here we go.
Oh, Yeah, it's the Middletown Dreams, the which I love.
Oh, it's
I
so
love
good.
That. But the fact that he does that almost after every single one, it's not a bad thing at all. In fact, musically, I love it. It's just the fact when I was compiling this, it made me laugh. I was like, oh, yeah, that's after like each
every
little lyric
one.
In that verse.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Even the one in Territories, dude, that is so good.
Oh, gosh, love it.
So, like, I thought it was really interesting that was, I mean, at least from like coming from, like an engineer's perspective or like a mixing engineer's perspective, if I was going to be doing something like this, that's exactly what I would want, is something that could pierce through the top of like the fullness, because you can't get into that 1K area where the bass is sitting, right? As you, to your point earlier, it was more like in the mid range. You don't want to get into that area. You got to stay high. And so I thought that was just super interesting. Like just this small little amp cranking it through and just adjusting to make his guitar parts sit in a pleasant way, because even though they're quite harsh, they don't hurt to listen to. Like it's not fits. It just sounds like it fits. And honestly, I find a hard time finding a lot of 80s prog rock guitar that I enjoy. I'm trying to think of just stuff out there. I mean, obviously, of course, Pink Floyd and you know, David Gilmour was doing his stuff throughout the 80s with Momentary Lapse of Reason and stuff like that, which has some really pleasantly nice guitar stuff, but not like, you know, it's much different from this. This is just a different type of playing that's incorporated in this style of music during the 80s. So any thoughts on that? Just anything that comes to mind in terms of, ever thought about that in terms of the guitar, how it sits within the music?
I mean, I've always loved Alex's playing. We've mentioned it before on here, but some people may not have heard the previous records. Again, mentioning Marcus here. Marcus is a phenomenal guitar player. He's a phenomenal musician in general. But, you know, he composed a lot of his stuff on guitar. Marcus did. And he said, you know, as a guitar player, he's one that I would hardly ever say instinctively, oh, I wish I could play that. It was more of this, I wish I had thought of that. Mm. And I think that is a testament to him as a player in general, Alex Lifeson, I mean. And that definitely shines through on this record as well, I think, is like the guitar parts that when you're not being smothered by the synthesizers.
Yeah.
When you're noticing the guitar parts, they fit really well. Like you say, they blend to the rest of the song very, very well. They add this little element here and there of like, ooh, that was nice. Ooh, that was really nice. And the chords that he uses there are very broad as well. They complement the synthesized sequencer stuff. You know, they build up a very big, luscious soundscape as well. You know, I mean, crud, think of The Big Money right off the bat. That big guitar chord. Mm-hmm. Very simple, but man, the sound of that is brilliant.
Yep, and the end. This is crazy. It just goes nuts with it. I love it. So I was listening through Power Windows and I went through every single guitar section that Alex plays, every single part that he plays, and marked it for what he's playing during those moments, whether they're just like little licks, leads, stuff like that, or they're chord-based riffs or arpeggios. And this is what I found. There's 101 guitar sections. 52 of those are arpeggios and 49 are chords. Like right down the middle. Now, of course, those are excluding some of the little licks, like the wah da da da, you know, that kind of thing, because he's playing chords behind that during that section. But little licks, those are excluding those. But like main parts, 52 arpeggios and 49 chords. Like it's almost like right down the middle. So I just love that, how balanced it is. And how he's able to do multiple different things on top of all the really great solos that he's playing, and including just multifaceted musician coming in with just all kinds of different ideas and stuff like that to add to this album. It's not just a synth record. That's kind of the point I want to get to.
Okay, yeah.
It's like this is not just a synth record. It's very synth heavy, but I love the guitars in it. But yes, what were you saying?
I agree. I will say though, as far as like some of his solos. I not to say that this is devoid of it. There are less iconic, awesome, excellent, amazing Rush guitar solos on here than there are previous records.
But there's Marathon.
I would agree.
But I was about to say that segues into what's the exception here. There are some great records or solos on this record, but the best one is Marathon.
It's just, it's the best
from a guitar solo perspective. It's brilliant.
It's the best. It should
do you have an excerpt of that?
I do. You want to play it?
You've got it.
Here we go.
Please play some of Marathon.
I'm about to rock out
the guitar solo. Great bass lick too.
Oh, I know.
And great drum rhythm too.
Fabulous drum. Fabulous bass.
Everything about that whole section. It's not even just the solo. It's everything else. Like, the bass is going nuts. Neil is just unleashed during that moment, too. And the chord, I was telling you this. I made that video because I was figuring out. I was like, why is that chord that after that?
And that
chord come in.
Feel.
Yeah. I was like, what is that? Something like musically. And I found out because the chords of the main chorus there starts with the B major and then it hits like an E major, F sharp major, then back to the E major. And then there's this G sharp minor and F sharp major. But when it flips to that section, it goes to a B minor and then hits like that. It's like an F sharp minor and then to the E again. So it flips from major to minor right there. And I was like, I don't even know why that's so satisfying, but it just sounds so good. I just had to figure out what structurally, like compositionally was going on right there. Cause it's so good. Anyway, I'm done. I'll stop talking.
It's great. That's wanted to share that little nugget there for people who haven't heard Power Windows. Great guitar moments in here. But there is a lot of synth too, but it's a different Rush feeling than you're going to get from something like Moving Pictures or A Farewell to Kings or 2112. Like, it's a very, very different record, but definitely deserves to get some attention.
It needs,
yeah,
for sure. Now, real quick though, I wanted to know, and maybe this could be like the last question here as we wrap up. But Rachel, in terms of the lyrical themes, in terms of the stuff that's going on, how do you see that connect with the album cover?
A mini edition of Illustrations and Impressions.
Mentioned that you wanted me to look into this and specifically and talk about this. I was like, oh yes, I get so excited about analyzing, you know, like the art and the art and the lyric together and how this fits, because it's so important to me. And there are many things that, like, certain albums that I'm like, why did they pick that cover or what, you know, other than just, oh, it's the band's face on the, you know, front of the album. You're like, okay, whatever.
Right.
But there are certain images that you're like, what, there's got to be a significance to this beyond the fact that this was just looked cool, you know? So I did a little bit of digging into this, and like the history behind the album cover as well. Like how, you know, it came about.
Great.
I just want to read you a little bit of that. But it was, they had their art director since 1975 was a man named Hugh, and I'm probably going to mispronounce the last name. It's spelled S-Y-M-E.
Syme.
I don't know if that, is it Syme or is
it Hugh Syme.
Like Hugh Syme? Okay,
yeah.
Gotcha. Thank you. So he was their art director since mid-70s. And he painted this album cover based off of reference photos by Demo Safari, a photographer with, you know, the blonde man, shirtless, you know, disoriented looking, trying to control his window with a remote control. That is the image that you're given. And the idea behind this, connecting with the lyrics of desiring to control the world through a remote control. And we all have, and a quote from him, talking about the concept of everyone has their own power window, or their own, hopefully, window into power. He says, quote, "Today it's a handheld cell phone or tablet or laptop or whatever. Then our power window to the world was a TV. So we link this in with the TVs in a minute, with, you know, the TVs in the background. It was controlling everything from our taste to our concept of what was news. So the TV became important. But the pun of a lone character with the misguided notion that he could control the world with his remote control was important to me, was more important to me than the TVs." So when he originally painted this portrait, it did not have the TVs in it, in the background, right? So he shows the image to the band, and Getty immediately says, "I love it. Where are my TVs?" He wanted the TVs in the background. And that was just not the initial image that you had. But this article that I was reading was Hugh Syme saying how much more significant it becomes when you have his back turned to the very thing that the remote is meant to control, and trying to control the entire world with the remote control instead of what's right behind him in his actual space that he can control. It was not actually Hugh Syme's initial vision, but it added so much more significance to have this vision of, you know, this man in this room, his back completely turned away from the very thing that the remote control is meant to control, something in his purview that he could control, and wanting to now control not just the television, but an entire world with that one device.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it's something I never thought about. That's really, really cool.
Right. Well, and this also is so interesting. Part of the quote as well that I did not read, I had to start digging into this because I had never heard. And this shows my lack of education. So, you know, if you guys already know what this alludes to, then please, by all means, tell me that I have no, you know, no education. But Hugh Syme says, "We only alluded to the Marshall McLuhan aspect of the TVs when we started talking about what was then our power window." Do you guys know who Marshall McLuhan is?
No idea.
Okay. Drew, I thought this was very interesting when I was looking up. I was like, who is this person? Obviously, this has some significance in this quote, you know, and plays into the album cover.
Right.
He was a Canadian philosopher, and I'm saying it plays into you, Drew, because Genesis, Peter Gabriel actually uses his name in a line in Lamb Lies Down on Broadway. Marshall McLuhan, casual viewing, it buried in the sand. Interestingly enough, and I was like, oh, it's kind of cool. But he coined the research behind media theory, and it's talked about a lot more nowadays.
See the person who says whoever controls the media controls the mind.
That could have been his most coined expression. Is the medium is the message?
Okay.
Yeah. Right. And the term and the idea of a global village. He was very prominent in the 50s and 60s. And he actually had the idea of basically the World Wide Web before we had the World Wide Web, and the significance of the idea of computers and those at first just being used in, you know, massive organizations, computers, for simple data and compilation in that way, but not necessarily being used as social devices yet, but knowing the magnitude that the power behind the computers and the ability that they would have to connect the world. And so this idea also plays into power and the kind of, it is kind of an ominous to me. And maybe that's not necessarily the right word, but the album cover for Rush, for Power Windows, does have this very ominous feel.
Absolutely.
And this this heaviness that you clearly feel in some of the music. And I'm not saying I'm talking more lyrically, you know, than necessarily the music itself. But it's very refreshing, like I said, that there is also hope in the lyrics too. But, you know, this idea, the medium is the message. So regardless of whatever message you're trying to get out there, it so matters what your medium is. And his research was very just this is what it is. It wasn't necessarily positive or negative. He wasn't trying to necessarily push for one or the other. You know, there are lots of debates nowadays about social media and, you know, the great things that it can do, but also the very negative impact it is now having on society as well. And so Marshall McLuhan's research isn't necessarily stating one way or the other that this is positive or negative. He's just saying this is what's true, is whatever medium you're using is part of your message. So to have the TVs added, you know, linked for Hugh Syme and Rush, this idea that we're going to throw this medium of something also very powerful of a TV, and yet it's not powerful enough for the disoriented, the man in the, you know, in the painting wanting to control the entire world.
Right. I also find it interesting as well, is that as you see out the window that he's looking at, there is kind of a storm that's going on.
Yes, I was going to say what kind of a day is it out there?
Yeah. And it's almost as if he's trying to control the storm, right? He's trying to stay he's trying to protect himself. He's trying to close the window, it seems, with the remote control to protect himself from the storm that's outside his house or something of that nature.
Ooh, interesting. I've never thought about it that way. I've thought maybe he is wanting to bring about the storm.
Oh, really? Ooh.
With that grasp for power.
Yeah.
Not close himself off from the world, but to continue to control it.
Yeah.
You know, the themes of nationalism that are very big in this album as well.
Right. Some like territories.
Manhattan Project
and
territories is, yeah.
Maybe, but I don't know. I'm kind of inclined to think about Destin maybe trying to shelter himself, in the sense that why is he shirtless? When you're not clothed, you're to me, that is synonymous or attaches with vulnerability. 100%. I was going to say that word. He's vulnerable right there. Right?
And
why would he allow himself to be
expression,
vulnerable? Why?
Yeah, and his expression is very, you know, as Hugh Syme said, disoriented. It's a disoriented young man.
Vulnerable, and there's a storm outside. Maybe he is trying to use the remote to kind of, you know, I don't know.
But maybe not close the window. Maybe change the weather. That's the whole thing. Maybe not cut himself off, but have the power to change it.
To change it.
Yes.
That's a good perspective too.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Now what about the guy in the TV though? Like with the guy with the binoculars. Is it binoculars?
I thought that was him and a different.
I thought it was
area,
him too. It's
like
on the
a
back
version.
It's
of
on
him.
The back of the vinyl, but it's also in the TV. The first
in the TV that he's like looking at himself. You know.
I don't know what's going on there, man. It's a little weird out for me, man. I'm just kidding.
I'm thinking about that.
What would he be looking at, or
perhaps this idea of the medium as the message being trapped in this medium?
Yeah, maybe.
Or, I mean, this is all that. Oh, thank you. Yeah. That the remote control, as much as you want it to control the weather, the window, what have you, it really does only just control the TV.
Yeah. It's a really brilliant album artwork. I mean, and honestly, from the years that I've been listening to this, I've honestly never really put forth the thought of going, what the heck is that?
Yeah.
What is that all about? Honestly. But now knowing that, I kind of like how open-ended it is almost.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I that's what I love is things that are just totally up to interpretation because you can hear somebody else's perspective and go, oh my gosh, I never thought about it that way before. And it's not something you can immediately just dismiss somebody else's opinion on what it means. Like, no, dude, you're completely wrong. That's, you know, it's like, no, there are lots of possibilities here.
Yeah.
Right.
That's really great. Thanks for that. Thanks for bringing
that. Well, yeah. And thank you for the historical context and all that. That's really cool. Like what Hugh Syme had intended and McLewis. Interesting.
That's really good. Yeah. Do we have anything else to say about this record or any final thoughts?
I'm sure we could.
Probably could. We are running a little low on time.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Rachel, for being here. This is great. I'm so glad that we got to do this. It's been way too long.
I know. Way too long. Don't make me wait so long, guys. I mean, every time I look at my phone, you know,
just
on your every word.
Just waiting on it to happen. Well, we would like to thank everybody listening to our podcast. These are our prog notes for Power Windows. If you enjoyed the episode, learned something new from the episode like I did, please subscribe. There's plenty of ways that you can support the show if you'd like to. You can become a special Prog Notes patron with all that big money at patreon.com/prognotes. You could also check the link in the description. It'll take you to all of those links. You can get access to extra benefits just outside of our episodes. If you can't do that, leaving us a review on the show would be great. That'll help the algorithm get the podcast to more people.
Your medium is the message.
The medium's Destin, the message.
And, you know, what are you trying to... All this power that you're trying to grasp from all of these people and influence them with their algorithms.
I know. All the algorithms that
we're
helping
listeners,
grasping. Destin. Beware the algorithm, everybody.
And how he's trying to influence you.
Oh, gosh. That's exactly right. I'm just trying to help, you know, get you to, you know, make sure... Yeah, with the power window of podcasting. Power windows of podcasts. So, also, don't forget to follow the new Spotlight feed. Of course, the link is in the description. Drew, before we close out, can you tell us what is the next record we're checking out? What are we listening to next?
Next record is Black Noise by FM.
Don't know it, but it's going to be great. So join us next time as we discover the past, present, and future of prog rock. We will see you guys on Discord. Thanks.
Hey, you know, thanks.